This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Hello guys, this is Clint Locklear for Trapping Across America. Well, we're going to be talking about some pretty unusual things tonight. I think we're going to talk a little bit about beaver butt, zombie rifles, ADC business, and what I commonly refer to as just nasty trapping. And you find out it's pretty effective, but it is pretty nasty when you look at it the way a lot of us trap today. But it's still extremely powerful when you do. Now, I want to start off with an email that I've got, because it's an interesting email, and there's some things that it's a lot to put into an email back. So I'm just going to say, hi, Clint. My name is Andy. I'm not going to say his last name. 22 years old, living in northern Kentucky. I'm currently on a second year trapping. I have a standard 40-hour work week in metal fabrication shop. Listen to all of your podcasts. I've been seriously thinking about starting my own ADC business. I want to start out on the right way and do it smart and efficient. But since I'm only my second year of season, my inventory equipment is very low. I wonder what will be a good amount of inventory, type of inventory to start out with. I don't believe I have much competition in my area. I'm a short 35-minute drive from a few larger towns. Thanks for the information you can provide. Keep up the good work, what you do. Thanks for helping me out. Okay, Andy. Great question, by the way. It is a very cool question, and it's one that I may not be the most absolute best person, because when you say ADC, are you referring to like what I do with predator control, or are you doing what most guys consider ADC, which is, you know, you're catching squirrels and moles and raccoons and all that type of stuff? If that's what you're doing, the inventory is going to be very different, and I really don't know that much about it. But what way I would look at this is, you're starting out the business, and I can already tell from the email you may have something a little backwards there. And it's common, guy. I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting that little bit backwards. But a trapper, and I think I've talked about this before, a trapper is a technician. And a technician does something. Like, you know, a technician can be a really good knife maker, or makes black rifle, black powder magazines, or it could be someone that's an artist, or it could be a carpenter that builds cabinetry. You know, and when you're a technician, when you think in terms of being a technician, you kind of don't ask the right question some of the time. Not that that's the wrong question, but it leads me to think maybe some of the priorities are just a little bit off. Not saying they're really bad off, but maybe just a little bit off. And what I mean by that is, see, a technician, when he's looking at it from when you put your technician hat on, you look at it in terms of inventory, tools, you know, how you're going to get to point A to point B, what the job's going to be, what's it going to take to do that job, and all that. And that is important. With ADC, that is definitely important. But let me be honest with you, man. That is not, to me, the most important thing when it comes to starting an ADC business. It's really not. The trapping part and the trap part of that is only going to be, if you're going to be successful at this, probably only about 30% of what you're going to be doing, especially for the first couple of years, maybe 3 or 4, depending on how well you catch on to it. It's not so much if you can go catch the animal, and that's a big lesson for a lot of guys. And I don't know if I'm just kind of reading between the lines, and I may be reading between the wrong lines. So if I go off on a tangent, you know, excuse me about this. We're going to get to the inventory part. But trappers think that if they are a good trapper, that they're automatically going to be a good business person. Or if they're younger to trapper and they start getting some success, sounds like kind of you probably have to be thinking this way, that, you know, since you're a good trapper, people are going to want you because you're a good trapper. And then they get out in the business world side of this, and it is not that way. Because to someone that's got a squirrel in their house, or even a coyote that's eating their, you know, genetically modified deer, they don't look at a trapper in the same way that trappers look at trappers. Because, you know, we look at, you know, who catches what and how quick, and, you know, they've been doing this for a long time, they seem successful. That's the way we look at it. That's not the way they look at it. They look at a trapper from the, you know, civilian point of view outside of trapping. They look at that clearly and almost exclusively from a technician that's going to come out and he's going to do something. So in their minds, you're no different than a plumber, a carpenter, someone that's going to dig up their septic tank, put a new roof on their house, paint their walls, whatever it is. You know, an IT guy that's going to come in and fix their computer. You're just another service person that they're going to use. And there's not going to be a lot of loyalty to that whatsoever. And because you're a really good plumber, really good carpenter, takes a long time to build up enough social capital for that really to matter. So the reason I'm saying all this is you have to understand, because I've had friends that try to do the predator control thing, and they get it in their head that they're really good and they can make demands on the customer, and then they find out they're pretty much out of business or off the job. You know, and I'm not thinking you're going down that route. I didn't feel any arrogance whatsoever in your email. But just keep that in mind. When you're going to do ADC or predator control, you're just another service type person that someone's going to use. Okay, so really, what should you be worried about way more than the inventory of the traps? Well, first off, you know, who specifically is going to be your customer? I mean, that needs to be the most important thing you do, especially starting out. And the reason you need to target that down. So animal damage control is a big type of industry. I mean, you can have someone that's catching chipmunks and squirrels and attics and roofs and nutria in the back pond and beaver and coyotes and all that. So the inventory of that can be greatly burdensome when you first start. You know, because if you're going to try to do everything for everybody, the inventory is going to be an issue. But see, a smarter guy that understands kind of more of the business side than he does the trapping, and that's where I want to lead you down before we get into the inventory part of this. Where you really need to get is where you know exactly who your customer is. So, you know, kind of talk around. What is the one of the major problems that people are having in your area for whatever type of ADC you're doing? If it's squirrels, great. If it's beaver, great. If it's bobcats, great. If it's white rhinoceroses, great. As long as you know what that is. And then you'll kind of look around and go, okay, maybe what's the second one? And maybe, you know, the most thing that happens up there with you is squirrels through it, chewing through the soffit, or maybe it's raccoons getting in the attic, or skunks, or moles in the, you know, golf courses and in rich neighborhoods, whatever that is. So you got to kind of categorize what type of customer can you go for, because it's going to make a big difference on if you're successful or you just kind of flounder around a little bit. So let's say that I'm in your shoes and I'm looking around and I kind of hear what people are saying and I talk to other ADC guys and, you know, or I start to take inventory of what people are asking for. So like if, you know, 4 out of 5 things are, say, squirrels getting in the attic, you know, so we're just going to use that for an example. If you think that's what it is, well, see, now I'm going to look at it from a business owner's point of view, not a trapper's point of view, but a business owner's point of view. Okay, the demand seems to be mostly with squirrels. Now, if I'm starting out building inventory, is it easier for me to build up an inventory on the different type of things I need to catch squirrels? Because squirrels, from what I can tell from people that do that, they do some really weird things in really weird places. So you've got traps that can be on the roof, you've got them you can screw to the side of the wall, you've got them you put in the building, one-way doors, killer traps, you've got all this. But it's kind of one thing. And if that's what a majority of it is, think of what the waste of resource is going to be if you go out and you start buying all these coon cages and, you know, the beaver traps that you can set in the neighborhood pond because, you know, it's just a big cage thing or something like that, or, you know, whatever it is, or a bunch of coyote traps because you're hoping to one day get some coyote stuff, but you're burning that resource when you should be burning it on what specifically you're going to target. Because if a business owner specifically targets a part of ADC, they can gain so much more traction than trying to be an everything to everybody, because you don't really mean as much in the customer's mind if you do that. So if you find out, say, that squirrels are what you're doing, well, dude, you need to be the squirrel man, you know, the Kentucky squirrel man, or whatever it is, you know, the city squirrel man or something like that. You know, that's what I would really push on the niche part of what that is, because with limited resources and time, and you're not going to do as well if you're out there trying to do everything for everybody. So first thing that I would say is you need to figure out what your customer is, what that niche that you can feel the easiest is. You know, you're working a 40-hour work week. So you're not going to have all day to do this. If it's something like, beaver control, and it's really rural, where you're going to get a lot of these jobs, you're going to have to walk in with four-wheelers and stuff like that. That's going to be really hard to do with a 40-hour work week. Where squirrels, if you're driving 35 miles and you get two or three jobs at a time, I don't think that's a very time-intensive way to go about it. So I would look more towards stuff like that, or mold control, or something. But you got to find that niche. Now, once you find that niche, you know what that customer is, and then you need to figure out how is that customer going to know that I'm in business? And this is where that 70% of where a lot of ADC guys get squashed is they're still thinking like a technician or a specialist of a trapper, and they're not thinking about everything to do with a business. So then you're going to have to figure out what it's going to be with a business. Is putting an ad in the paper the best way? You could run a couple of trials. I'm probably going to, I'd be shocked if it is. Putting in the Yellow Pages, since no one really uses Yellow Pages anymore, that's probably not going to be the best way to do it. You're probably going to have to learn how to be online and how to get marketing that way, which is a different skill set. You don't have to spend a lot of money on a website, but you're going to have to learn how to set it up. You're going to have to learn about search engine optimization. So the people that you want to find you will find you, because if you're picking up business in Canada, that's a long way from you, so it's a waste of your time to be picking those customers up. So you got to figure out how to concentrate the internet stuff, if that's what you're going to do, around your specific area. And then you're going to have to build content around that about squirrels. Now, one of the things that I think a lot of guys don't do, which if I was in that type of business, I would. If I was going to be centralized in an area doing animal damage control, I bet you I can go to any one of the major newspapers and go in and talk to the editor and go, look, man, here's what's going on out there. And you want your newspaper to be relative? I'm sure you do. And I will volunteer a monthly or a weekly article on something that's really hitting people right now. And then you can go into some of the statistics about squirrel damage, the problems with the urines and the droppings, the drop of the value of the property because they're chewing through people's houses, it's embarrassing when people over there, whatever that is. You can come up with 10 or 15 different articles like that, and trust me, you can if you really put your mind to it. And then you could go into almost any newspaper would be willing to do this, especially the time of year when most people are having trouble, if we're talking squirrels. So you're going to go in and you're going to do that, and your tagline is going to be, the squirrel man, or the whatever you come up with, because you got to start working on a brand. That's one of the main things. And a brand's just how people perceive you. That's not necessarily a name or a logo, but it's an overall brand. But that would be one cool way to be in the newspaper, because even if the person that's reading it, and value and loss possibly could be in the average home when they get infested with squirrels. Anybody with a house is going to come across that. I promise you, is going to skim an article with a title, something like that. And then you have written by, Kentucky Squirrel Man or Squirrel Protector, or not Squirrel Protector, but Rid a Squirrel or whatever. And you have this information. It's short, precise. It's to the point. And then you don't market your business in that. That's one thing. If you try this, don't do that. You just have at the bottom, when they have your little bio at the bottom, so-and-so, SEO, or owner of whatever the ADC company is, and I wouldn't even put a phone number in there unless the newspaper asked you to. Because what you're trying to do is build a brand. See, once you know who your customers are, you got to find ways to get in front of them. The same thing is with the online stuff. You can have a website, and if you don't reach the customers you want to reach, it's a waste of time. But if you do, if you learn a little bit about it, and we go all over this stuff for $299 in our business course, which is opening now, and that's not the reason I'm doing that, but you can do it my way, where it took me about 10 years to figure all that out, or you can find a course or somebody that can mentor you in your local area that is probably already rocking in something like that. It could be a totally different service. It could be a plumber, for instance. you know, or I would even go talk to some of them, the ones that seem to be all over the place. Like if I was going to get in the eye surgery service around here, I would want to go pick the brain of the doctor that I had, which is Dr. DiStefano, because everybody in five counties knows who she is. I mean, her brand is amazing. Now, if I could sit down with her and get her to sit down, even if I had to pay her, how did she come around, come up to that point of doing that? Man, that'd be invaluable information. But, you know, you're going to have to know how to get those customers in line. And then once you get the customers and you get that brand start building, and then you're going to start getting calls from that branding. Now we're getting into what type of inventory do you need? So you can tell already, unless you've just got a boatload of money, I would target one or two things that seem to be the most prominent and the most high profit and time-wise that you can do at the time. See, even if squirrels are the main thing, and let's say moles are like three or four or five down the list, but there's still a lot of that work, and everybody's going to be fighting over the squirrels, from a business owner, I'm going to back down, probably go for the moles. You know, it's quicker, it's simple, you don't have to check the traps every day in most states because of what it is. The landowner can call you when the little flag goes up on the trap to come get the thing. You can work out all type of, you know, plans where we'll protect your yard for a year, and this is what the protection, you know, it costs, kind of like the mafia. You could do something like that. But then you get into inventory, and the reason I go back to the niche is if you're limited on resources, which most of us are, and you try to go in and be something like a critter control, you know, big agent, they probably got 50, 60, 70, maybe $100,000 worth of inventory. You know, they've got garages full of every trap to catch groundhogs and squirrels and beavers and coyotes and moles and whatever else you come in contact with. And they've got all these different scenarios and all these different chimney caps. And they've got all this type of stuff that really, really eats into cash flow. But if you concentrate with what you're doing, then you can do your inventory on a much more reasonable level. So if I was going to do squirrels, the first thing I would do probably is find somebody that's completely out of my area. Like call up Alan at Wildlife Control Supplies or his son Andy, and go, hey, do you know anybody that's in, if I was in Tennessee, do you know anybody that's in, you know, South Georgia, Northern Kentucky, something like that you know they know what they're doing with squirrels and stuff like that, that seems to be like a decent person, you know, do you have anybody like that? And I'm sure Andy or his father would go, yeah, we know this guy. He's over in southern Indiana, and he buys a lot of traps. He's got a great reputation, all this, that, and other. Can I get his phone number? They'll probably give it to you. Or you can look it up online if you get the name. Then I would call him up, and then before I started buying inventory, I'm setting the ground rules strategy ahead of time. I would call him up and go, look, I live here. We're 450 miles apart. I'll sign whatever you want me to sign if you feel uncomfortable. I'm looking to ride around with you, and I will pay you for a week if you can get time off from your shop work. I'll pay you for a week or 4 days just to see kind of how you run your business, and I'm willing to pay for it. I'm not going to be a burden. You don't have to put me up. You don't have to feed me. You know, I'll be your gopher, free labor for a week, and go watch how he kind of does his business and see what type of traps, and you can kind of pick his brain as you're going from job to job, like what are the best traps you use or something like that. And you can probably do a lot of this on the phone, even if you did it in a courteous type way. You don't want to pester somebody. That way you would know what the best traps and everything are, you know, to me. And the biggest thing that I can tell you from being around a lot of guys that get into the trapping side of stuff, whether it be ADC, fur, or predator control, they automatically have this assumption that the more cool equipment they have, the better it's going to be when they go out on a job. But see, what they don't take into consideration is they burned resources they might need for income on stuff they're probably never going to have out all at the same time anyway. You know, I've had friends that try to get in the predator control business, And they, you know, they end up buying new welders because they want to make some stuff. And then they've got, you know, 300 traps that are completely functional, but they want to have the best, latest, and greatest. So they sell those and they buy those and they're upside down and they're not going to catch any more coyotes in front of it. So inventory gives comfort, it seems like, to a lot of people, especially technicians, because they feel like it's going to make them better. You know, like for me, you know, having 1,000 CDR cat traps to go to Texas with is ridiculous because I can only probably run, you know, somewhere between 75 and maybe 180, something like that, on a 24-hour check, you know, if someone else is running the fence. So me getting all that equipment for just in case, it's just a waste of time. So when if I would be looking at inventory, and since I don't know what you're doing, we're going to say it's squirrels. Okay, what is the basic squirrel traps that you have? And because you have a 40-hour work week, you're not going to have, you know, 50 jobs a week probably. So I would probably, you know, try to get a dozen of whatever that is. And then, okay, what if they're chewed a hole in the side of the house? You know, is there a modification I can do to that? Or is there a trap that I can screw to the wall because, you know, maybe 20% of the time I'll need it? I might get 5 or 6 of those. You know, I'd get some, you know, some different size, smaller body grips and figure out ways to mount them in places that you would need them. I would try to keep cash outflow as small as possible when you're starting out. Because the more money you spend when you're starting out, the more money you got to make before you break even from when you started. And that's what kills a lot of businesses, is not understanding that principle to begin with. So say you got $10,000 in savings. You're all excited about doing this. You go burn through that money. You know, you finally make the jump. You're going to go full time. You get 2 or 3 bad months just because there's no calls for whatever reason. You don't have the cushion, and then you don't have the income coming in, and you could be in serious financial trouble if you don't have any way to handle that. So definitely keep that in mind, you know, when you're doing that. I would get maybe 10% more than you think you would need on if you're going to try to only do, you know, 5 or 10 jobs a week if you got that many. Because when you start out, you think it's going to be more than it is, and it's a lot rougher. And then you, over time, you get more jobs than you think you ever could be, but it's going to take several years for that to happen. So I would keep that very, very low. Now, since you have a full-time job, my next recommendation is you do not touch the money that you bring in. So if you go do a squirrel job and you net, say, $100 after expenses on the job, for the first couple of years, you shouldn't even look at that as its income to you. That's the business's income. If you need more inventory, that buys your inventory. If you need to do, start a really good Facebook presence and you want to target people in certain states and different things you can do with that, or Google Ads or whatever, that's what that money's for. Or that money is to get a website going or something like that. It's not to go out and spend. You know, unless you have to do it because you're going to starve to death and lose your house, that money is non-touchable. And if you have a wife, y'all need to have an agreement with that when you start with. If you're going to build that business, the best business, in the way that I've done everyone I've ever done, is I do what I can do with what I have, and then I put the extra that I make into that. So then what I can do with what I have is a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. You know, if someone tried to emulate me 2 years into trapping, if you were to see the 55-gallon drums of traps and stretchers and all that other stuff, I mean, you're going to have to go out and drop probably 30, 40 grand to do that. I did it over 25 years. You know, when I get extra money, I want to try this, I'll go get that. But I didn't. But when I started, really the only thing, that if I remember when I started, I may have got probably a couple dozen extra 330s and maybe 6 or 12 of the number 5 Bridgers, which you have better stuff now, but stuff like that. That's all I did. So when I made money, any excess went back into that business and inventory, and only if I needed it. I didn't go get a brand new truck so I could, you know, put stuff all over the sides and, you know, what most businesses do. But I was very cautious, even when I did the pool business or anything else. You let the business grow itself because you're smart about what you're doing. If you try to force it with money, most of the time, those businesses are the 80% that always fail. So, I hope that helps you a little bit. I know it's a strange way to answer that question. If you're talking about predator control and equipment, dude, depending on what your laws are in your state, you know, I'd probably learn how to build snares. If you can do snares, get a 5,000 foot roll because it's much cheaper. Build your own snares. Probably have an inventory of somewhere of maybe 60 good coyote traps. They don't have to be the best, but good. And then I would get some, you know, if you're going to be around that, you're going to be around a lot of feeders. I'd get me some DPs like the FB2s or 1s or something like that. But that would be about it. And realistically, you move those a lot. A couple of dozen of those can do a lot of damage on a property in a couple of weeks with the DPs. So you don't need 100 to do what you're doing. And you don't have that outlay. So, man, I wish you good luck with that. If that did not answer your question, let me know. Because I don't really have that much information about it. All right, guys. Now we're going to have a little bit of fun. That was a little serious. Now we're going to have a little bit of fun. Have you ever, if you don't know this, me and Jeff Dunlap are like Walking Dead fanatics. We talk about it. We watch it. We're like kids on Christmas Eve when the new season comes on. I don't know why. I mean, we're texting like two little schoolgirls back and forth during the show. I mean, so the zombie thing, because of the show and the characters, we just enjoy it. You know, there's a couple other shows we're kind of like that, like with Vikings or something. But when you're looking at this, I want to tell you, and they're not sponsoring me. I don't get a dime if you go buy a truckload of these things. But this is a cool little rifle that an outdoorsman may find interesting in case there's ever the zombie apocalypse, because it is a neat thing. And it is a TNW Aero Survival Rifle, and that's AERO. You can look it up on YouTube and you can see what it is. It's a cool looking gun, but what they've done with it is fascinating to me, because like when me and you look at, okay, what would happen if there was the zombie apocalypse, which I don't think there is, but what happens if the economy crashes or, you know, something happens with the grid or whatever? Just these kind of things you kind of think about, which everybody has at one time of their life. And one of the big things that I wondered about on something like Walking Dead, you know, I've got a ammo inventory because I'm a prepper that I can pretty much arm half of my county if I so deem fit, you know, and they would have bullets. But, you know, I keep certain calibers that I have. Lots of 45s, lots of 308s, a lot of 223, some 9mm, bunches and bunches of 22s. But I don't have like 380 and 40 Smith & Wesson. I'm looking in, for some reason, I'm getting a wild hair about wanting some 10mm stuff. So then I'll have to boost up that inventory. But let's just say if we're actually ever going to have to go out and trappers going to have to defend the world against zombies, what type of rifle would you use? Now, this rifle that they have is really cool because it is a breakdown rifle. You just unscrew the barrel. You know, at 100 yards, from what it seems like, it's shooting about 3 to 5 inch groups, which is plenty for zombies. And the most important thing about it is a carbine blowback system. So it's not as complicated as an AR. It's looser. It's kind of like the old grease guns were back in World War II that the tankers had and stuff like that. Not the most accurate gun, but they're pretty much self, you know, you can't hurt one of them. So, I mean, it makes it a cool idea. You got to learn how a open bolt system works, because unless you've been in the military, you probably haven't been around that. But the cool part I want to tell you about, if you were in the zombies and the trappers had to defend everybody, and you had some 9mm, some 40 cal, some 45, some 10mm, this rifle shoots them all. And it's very simple to do. So if you know anything about ARs, the lower receiver is what is you're registered for. That's the gun. Well, somehow the lower receiver on this gun is not the gun. The actual tube is the gun. That's where the serial numbers and everything is at. So on the front of their bolt, you can take the front of their bolt off if you're shooting 9mm and the big zombies are coming. You could put in a clip and you could put in the 10mm part of that head, put the new barrel and change out the lower receiver. And it takes about 3 minutes. I mean, it's pretty simple. I watched several people do it on YouTube. It's really cool. So to me, I'm thinking during the zombie apocalypse, if we ever had to go there, how cool would it be to have a gun that you're almost sure that you'll be able to find ammo for anywhere? Because if 9mm, 40 cal, 45, 10mm. And they also have one in 357 SIG. Now that is a lot more, the SIG and the 10mm is a, you know, not as common of a gun. But it, you know, when you watch the show or you just think about what would happen, you're eventually going to run out of your own ammo and you're going to have to start scrounging. But if you had this gun with the extra barrels and the extra lowers, and they use Glock magazines, which there's millions of them things out there. So you've got this little submachine gun that's single shot that you can shoot all these different bullets for. And I just think that's cooler than snot right there. I mean, that is awesome to be able to do that. I'm seriously looking at having to get one of them just in case people start eating other people's brains or something else. Because to me, from a prepper's point of view, that's pretty cool. I don't know if they can switch out to the 22 and the 22 mag, but they do have that caliber. Now, if you could shoot the same rifle with a 22 as you could with a 10mm, I mean, you're talking about having your bases covered. And it's a light gun. It's very rugged. I think it wouldn't be a bad little, if you're in a state that, you know, really regulates your own pistols, if you were to get this and shoot and have it in the 22, probably wouldn't be a bad trap line gun. Or like we talked about the meat foraging, because it is so rugged, you could have that in your backpack and all of a sudden you're going down in your canoe and you see some deer and all you had to do is open that backpack and screw in the barrel, slowly put in the magazine and then take your deer. That's just a very cool thing to be able to do. So I was sharing that a little bit before we get into what I consider just nasty trapping. Now, nasty trapping is not unproductive trapping, guys, but it is a crude way to trap. But it is fairly efficient. And I do this a lot, especially when I'm in decent soil and I have very visible trails. Now, these trails that I'm doing it on most of the time are going to be next to rivers and creeks and swamps where you have, you know, the big main trail, you know, high bank trail, then you got a couple of the other smaller ones and stuff like that. I can go in, if I'm just using footholds, and very quickly make a set on those that are pretty freaking deadly. And you ought to give it a shot. You know, if you're going after coon and you're not using a DP, you'll be amazed at this. I actually learned this method from an older guy that I'm pretty sure is no longer around because he was about 80 then. And he told me, which I'm not going to get into, that all coons, talking about raccoons, are alcoholics if you give them the chance. And I didn't understand what he meant, so he went into how he trapped raccoons. And this old guy in Pennsylvania was knocking about 300 or 400 of them with using what I'm getting ready to tell you. And it is super quick. And it is super effective, but it is pretty ugly. I will give you that. So I kind of consider this kind of like nasty trapping. So I want you to visually go with me. We're down on a decent sized creek or a river, and you have the high bank trail, which is normally going to be within 15 or 20 feet where the main bank breaks off into the water. And that's where you're going to have your coyotes and your coon and your fox and your cats. Everything uses that. So do possums and skunks, unfortunately. But everything uses it. Now, you could go in that situation and set dirt holes in flat sets or just blind sets or anything else. You know, and that you're perfectly fine with doing that. Now, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, if I can get a trap in a trail where an animal's already walking, I'm like already giggling. I mean, it just, that's the world's right when that happens. So on this nasty style trapping, what this guy was doing is he had he was using one, I used two, because I'm overly paranoid about missing something. But he just had, all his system was, when he went out to the woods, was a trap, the stock chain, hooked to an extension cable that was 4 or 5 feet long, and on the end of the extension cable, it was a big secured loop. So I can explain how fast this is to you. When you're looking at an extension cable, you know, 3/32, whatever you're using, 1/8, and say it's 5 feet long, on the end, the trap's going to be hooked to, has got a small opening, so you can put, he's pre-rigging these, so you just put your your J-hook through that, and you crimp it. And then on the other end of his extension cable, you could probably fit a grapefruit through the hole, and it's secure. It doesn't slide back and forth. He doesn't want it to slide back and forth. So you got a big end and a small end hooked to a trap. Now, at his age and everything, what he was using was 1.5 Victors. That was his trap of choice. He had some long springs, but he was mostly a Victor guy, because that's kind of his time, age, and area. That's what it was. So cool. And all he would do is he would find these trails. He would just go down the trail till he found a tree or a sapling most of the time. And where he's at, there's a lot of pine and hemlock. Down here, it can be, you know, sugar gum or whatever. We just have different types, so it's irrelevant what kind it is. And he would, just around that sapling at the base, he would hook his extension cable, pull his trap through the big hole, kind of pull it tight, get it on the back side of the tree, and he would stomp with his boot enough to get that 1.5 Victor under the ground. Didn't even use a shovel or a hammer or anything unless he had to. So in the wintertime, it's normally wet and muddy. He stomps that into the ground. He beds his trap, and where he was putting it, I have a different trap placement, but I want to tell you what he was doing, because he was the original source of me doing this. He put his trap about 4 to 5 inches directly in front of, but on the trail of that tree. So think about how much equipment and how fast we've already done. You just take your extension table around, pull your trap through, stomp out on the ground with your boot, you have an indention, you push in the trap, you're directly in front of the tree 4 or 5 inches. With me playing with this set, I found it's better to have it off on an angle. That's the reason I use two traps hooked to one extension cable. They both can go through the big opening. So if you've got a tree, mentally do this in your head with me. You've got a trail and you've got a lone sapling sitting right there. It doesn't have to be lone, but just so we can keep the visual straight. You hook up the extension cable to the tree, and then I will stomp two beds in, and like around here on some of the rivers, it's sandy, so I can just scoop it out. So you're only talking a couple of seconds. I like long springs because they bed more, and then I'm putting them on a 45 degree angle about 6 or 7 inches away from the tree in opposite directions. So if you're looking from God's view down at the top of the sapling, and you see the trail in front of it, 45 degrees south and 45 degrees north, if the trail's running that way, I just crudely beat in these traps. Now, I'm not using a sifter, I'm not using anything. Then all I'm gonna do is just grab duff, grass, leaves, pine straw, whatever's there, which you're always gonna be able to find next to a river. You know, and if you got a bunch of that there, always go to the bottom of the pile, guys, because it's always finer. It's then broke down more. So you push off the top layer, reach down, get that stuff, put it over the trap, and if I see a little bit of the pan or a little bit of a jaw, I don't really worry about it. And then I'll put I will scatter that on the next trap, and then that's all I'm gonna do. No peat moss, no pan covers, no sifting, no anything. I do want it stable, which in mud, it's not hard to do. With the long springs, it's even easier. So I've got that, and then what he would do is he had this concoction that had alcohol in it that he just squirted on the front of this tree. And that's what he used. And he was telling me of, you know, some years he'd catch 40 and 50 gray fox. You know, he wasn't in an area that ever had a ton of reds, but he's had years up close to 100 reds by doing this. and he would catch 300 or 400 raccoon, a bunch of possums, different things like that. That was the only system he had. You can't get any nastier and uglier than that. And it works. And you can just as easily catch coyotes on that if you're I would move the traps a little bit farther away back down the trail. So if I think there's coyotes in the area and I'm going to be doing this, I may move the trap back where it's going to be 10 inches on that 45, but still have it in the trail. And the 45 doesn't have to be perfect because the tree's never going to be perfect to the trail. But just think about the speed of doing that. So if you know you're in an area and you've had a lot of rain like we've had lately, you could just, in a bag, throw 4 or 5 units of these traps when you get out of the truck or off your four-wheeler or out of a canoe. Have that in a bag with your lure or bait, and that's all you need. That's all you need. If it's a sapling that the roots are in the way, just move the trap over a little bit. It's probably still going to work just as fine. If it's one where there's a lot of roots, go find another sapling. You want to keep this system as simple and as nasty as you can get. So you're going to walk up, you're going to be on one of these trails, and these trails can be in the middle of fields, they can be in the middle of woods, it's irrelevant. Where I mostly use it though is, because that's where I do a lot of my trapping, is on the high banks. So you just go in, you wrap it around the tree, through the loop, you're not hooking with any clips or anything like that to screw with. It can't come off, because they'd have to cut the tree down at the base for it to happen, so you don't have to worry about that. And then you beat those in, you bed those in crudely, and you throw some leaves over it. And then you smear, and like for me, what I usually use around here is Federales and Cat Collector. Because Cat Collector is great for coyotes. It does really good on fox and bobcats, and coons like it. And then the Federales ump that up for the coyotes and the coons and everything like that. You never know what you're going to catch, but it is amazing how effective that simple of a set is. You know, and it just think about it. We're dealing with rain. Who cares? Let it rain. Who cares? No dirt holes are going to fill up on that because you don't have one. And in the bark of that tree where he was putting, because the reason I know that really intrigued me about what he was doing is he was doing it on a lot of these little pine trees. And he took several pictures that he showed me. And there's no bark on these trees. I mean, none whatsoever. He's caught so many animals that these trees from like 2 foot down is barkless. And I mean, you could tell how much activity went on here. But he was putting the lure about 12 inches off the ground or whatever. So I kind of went by his point of view on this. And I put my lure about 10 or 12 inches and then more closer to the ground. And I'm smearing it into the bark. I'm just not putting it on there. I mean, literally smear it into the bark. And then I take the Federales or another bait, whatever you're going to use, and smear that underneath that, directly facing the trail. And then when the animal's coming up, if he misses him on the first one, the way that I set it up, and he smells it, when he takes those other steps, think about it. You've got 4 chances on one trap and 4 chances on the other trap, and you times that by 2, I've got 16 chances with that to catch the same animal when I use the 2-trap method. Now, it's not pretty. It's not something you're probably going to want to be posting on Facebook or YouTube if you want people to think that you're like a really sophisticated style trapper, but it works. And it works very well. So I wanted to share that with everybody of what that is. Now I'm going to go into something that I think is funny. This may be a little bit shorter show. I apologize for that. But this is it's called Natural News. I've seen this website before. It's Natural News is what it is. It's the world's top news source for natural health. And this is the title. Now, some of what he's saying is real, and you can obviously, he don't really know what castor is, but it's still kind of funny. Why is the truth vilified and lies are celebrated? Beaver butt used, in quotations, natural flavoring in your food. Now, millions of people across the globe are eating beaver butt, and don't even know they're consuming such a substance. It's called castrum. Say a beaver butt in castrum, as we know as trappers, is not the same thing. One's a gland, one's an anus. You know, very different. But he doesn't know that. But he's probably came across what castrum was, and it grossed him out. So it's called castrum, and it's emitted from the castor sacs within the animal's anus. For a beaver, this slimy brown substance is used to mark its territory. For us humans, it's used as an additive and often labeled as natural flavoring. In foods we eat, like vanilla, strawberry, and raspberry, probably being most common. Now, I don't know if he's talking about ice cream or what. I don't know, think anybody's putting castor on in vanilla that I know of, or on strawberries or raspberries. That'd be pretty weird. But why is castrum used? Its most notable characteristics after being processed has to do with the smell of castrum. Instead of smelling horrible, like most people would expect from a anally produced secretion, it has a pleasant smell, which surprisingly makes it perfect candidate for food flavoring and other products. A lot of soft drinks have this in there, guys. The question that many people put forth would have to be, who in their right mind would actually make this odd discovery? And I would have to agree with that. I would have never thought about putting castor in a food product. Another industry that uses castrum is the fragrance world. For decades, perfume manufacturers have been using it to make various type of fragrances. These animal secretions are said to contain 24 different molecules, many of which act as a natural pheromone. From perfumes to air freshener, castor sacs are quite versatile within the fragrance industry. And it is. Sure, it's natural, but does being natural make it right for our consumption? Many disgusting substances are considered natural, yet eating them may not be the best idea. The act of labeling something so vulgar and disgusting as natural flavoring should be illegal in many people's eyes, but the FDA views it in a very different light. Having the anal secretions from a beaver take the place of strawberry in something like strawberry ice cream, so that's what he was talking about, seems like an effective process. Why go through the process of harvesting anal secretions when a strawberry is much easier to pick? It hardly seems like a better option. The food industry is a tricky business to figure out. It will continue to boggle the minds of many on issues exactly like this. Much like the other additives that have raised concern over the years, aspartame, high fructose, corn syrup, food colorings, castrum is provided to be just as questionable. It is deceptive labeling that seems to be the root of the problem. Instead of stating what castrum truly is, FDA allows it to be labeled as something that sounds pleasant and healthy. As with many questionable additives in today's food market, the power lies with the people. Read your labels. And then, you know, he goes on a little tirade. In all honesty, castrum is probably safe to consume, being that it is derived from an animal, but who really wants to eat a beaver's anus? I found that fascinating. You know, and it, to me, one of the main reasons is people have no idea what they're eating. I can tell you from a lure maker's point of view, when I play around with certain meats, with certain preservatives like zinc valerate or sodium benzoate or methylparaben, and you can take a meat and it will stay that way for pretty much ever. It will juice out a little bit over time, but it will stay preserved and will not rot. Now, since I use those products, and I look on the back of the labels, it makes me very uneasy eating a food like that because of it preserving it. Now, here's the reason I brought this up. Just so you think, because I know some of you think I'm crazy when it comes to some of the stuff I've been saying about food and different things like that. What you put in your body makes a big difference. If you're eating stuff that is totally loaded with sodium benzoate, which is a food product, that's what it is. It's in hot dogs, it's in all kind of stuff that it shouldn't be, and it keeps it from rotting. When your body digests that, guys, if the bacteria in the whatever the product is can't eat it, do you really think that you're going to digest it? That's always been my biggest thing. And the buildup of that stuff inside of a living organism like we are, what kind of damage is that probably doing? But the biggest thing is you're eating a food that bacteria, and that's what breaks down the food in your stomach. It's not you, it's the bacteria. If they can't eat it when it's in a product form and you swallow it and it goes down to your gullet, what do you think the bacteria in your stomach's going to do that the other bacteria can't do? Just a little food for thought there. You know, and I do agree with this article one thing. When he says the food industry is a tricky business. No, it's a lying sack of crap business is what it is. If you understood and looked at some of the stuff that I have about the marketing of food, there's a reason all these companies have an army of lawyers to see how far they can push deception and lies on labeling before they're going to get fined for it. If you really knew what was in everything that you had, you would be eating more like I've started eating than probably what most of y'all are eating because it's convenient. You know, and the other thing is, I think it's cool that an industry, just on a totally separate note, because I don't think castrum really, it doesn't seem like something I just want to eat, but it doesn't seem, that to me, that's nothing as bad as having sodium benzoate in food. And, you know, it's in so many different products. Women, it is, you just think of the visual. You got some little snotty blonde wife from New Jersey or something like on one of them shows, or Housewives of Atlanta. And what they don't realize, because the labeling on stuff is so confounded, is they're putting castrum all over their body in their perfumes or lipsticks and different stuff like that. And most of the moisturizing creams that women buy come from rendering plants. And if they knew what that actually meant, the oils in there, they call them all kind of cool stuff, but it's what it is. Had a buddy that worked at this plant, and the biggest customer that they had was cosmetic industry. They take all the dead cows, dead pigs, dead dogs and cats from the shelters, and what they do, like at hog farms, they take a trailer, they load up, it doesn't matter if it's 115 degrees, and they blow up in there and they do all kind of stuff. Then they take it to these big vats, they heat them up, they render the oil off of all that rotten meat, and then you've got all of these prissy women that are putting it all over their body. If they actually knew they were putting Rover oil and you know, Fluffy the cat oil and rotten horse and cow and everything else on their face, I would just love to see their expression when that was explained to them. So last thing is just kind of an interesting thing that Dennis sent this to me. I just thought it was interesting, so I'd share it with you. Guys, go out, enjoy yourself in the woods, have a good time, really take advantage, because the season is going to be winding down for a lot of you a lot quicker than others, so don't waste it if you've got a chance at it. And just go have some fun and get a little bit of dirt and blood on your fingernails and remember what it's like to actually be a human again.
Back in the wild again, and I feel right at home where I belong. I had that feeling coming over me again, just like it happened so many times before. Yeah. The spirit of the woods is like an old good friend. Makes me feel warm and good inside. And I knew his name, and it was good to see him again. 'Cause in the wind he's still alive. Old Fred Bear, walk with me down the trails again. Take me back where I belong. Oh, Fred Bear, I'm glad to have you at my side, my friend. And I'll join you in the big hunt for far too long.
for too long. It was kind of dark, another misty dusk. And it came from a tangle down below. And I tried to remember everything it taught me so well. I had to decide which way to go. Was I alone or in a hunter's dream? The moment of truth was here and now. I felt his touch, I felt his guiding hand. The buck was mine forevermore. Because of Fred Bear, I'll walk down these trails again. Take me back.
Say, Fred, you go up that ridge. Now go down to the swamp. We'll get that buck.
If some of our teenage thrill seekers really want to go out and get a thrill, let them go up into the northwest and tangle with the grizzly bear, the polar bear, and the brown bear. They get their thrill. That will cleanse the soul.